This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, editor of Tradition, with another Tradition podcast. Visit traditiononline.org for the bounty of content we've been publishing online a few times a week, and of course, to sample selections from our current issues. If you're not a subscriber, you can sign up for print or digital-only subscriptions right from our website, or now you can go to amazon.com, where we've just made the newest issues available for purchase in hard copy or via Kindle. Also, visit Tradition Journal on Facebook and give us a like to keep updated on everything happening at Tradition. By now, our listeners know that our fall 2019 issue is dedicated to re-exploring and re-evaluating Professor Chaim Soloveitchik's 1994 essay, Rupture and Reconstruction, The Transformation of Contemporary Orthodoxy. This was a rare case of a work of scholarship having a breakthrough to the popular life and imagination of a religious community. In my introduction to the symposium, I describe Rupture and Reconstruction as being a lens through which modern Orthodoxy has viewed and understood itself these past 25 years. But like most classics, Rupture and Reconstruction is known mostly for a boiled-down version of its famous central thesis and for a few choice terms or concepts such as mimesis and text community. It may not even have been read by many in our community who nevertheless have been informed by it and use its ideas to interpret communal phenomena or to advance an argument or an agenda. To help better understand Rupture and Reconstruction and the concepts and theories behind it, I sat down with Professor Adam Furziger, a social and intellectual historian from Bar-Ilan University and one of the contributors to the symposium. He provides us with a valuable Rupture and Reconstruction primer. Here's our conversation. One of the really curious things about Rupture and Reconstruction, this mammoth 60-plus page paper with its 103 footnotes, is that it was written by one of the most distinguished scholars in Jewish studies and intellectual Jewish life, who kind of comes to this topic, what becomes arguably his most famous piece of writing, that Chaim Soloveitchik comes to this topic from a very different place. In your contribution to the symposium, Adam, you write, the unique enterprise of Soloveitchik's academic wade into fresh territory was also reflected in the fact that at the time, study of contemporary American Judaism, including Orthodoxy, was dominated by social scientists and their quantitative and qualitative tool chest. The notion that an intellectual historian, whose preeminent asset was his ability to decode and contextualize antiquated religious writings, could proffer a compelling perspective on the present-day scene challenged this virtual hegemony. So explain to us a little bit what Professor Chaim Soloveitchik's field is, what his accomplishments as a scholar are, and how you use here the word unique. I might use the word curious it was that he made this important statement, this important piece of scholarship outside his principal field.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I'm going to talk about exactly what you asked me in a second. I just want to make it clear that when Chaim Soloveitchik came to this topic, he came to it as a renowned historian, somebody who had tremendous amount of, was given a lot of respect and acknowledgement in the field of medieval Jewish history, Jewish intellectual history, but also a huge Talmid Chacham in his own right, who had given a shiur, who had been a regular Talmud lecturer in Reitz, who's also the heir to the Soloveitchik legacy. And all of those factors, to my mind, had a role in why this essay drew people's attention even before it came, you know, as soon as they saw the name, the title, the subject, etc.
And also the venue in which it was published.
And the venue where so much of his father's seminal works came out, etc.
You go on to say that the very decision to publish the essay in Tradition signposted the author's desire to go beyond the ivory tower and impact the public that cared most viscerally about the topic at hand. And that's as the... as the current occupant of the editor's desk at Tradition, I think that really speaks to what our journal has always aspired to be. I think most often throughout our 60-year history has succeeded in being, which is a kind of scholarly journal that lives at the intersection of scholarship and an actual lived religious community, trying to be in communication with it in ways that scholarly journals aren't always interested in doing. So I thank you for that observation.
Well, I could enhance that or sharpen that by the fact that he did publish a prior version, which is shorter, which is more limited in its scope, and his decision to expand upon it and to add additional interpretation and even sort of his own perception from a spiritual point of view, I think attests to how much he saw his role here, not purely as a distant scholar who's looking at things from the side, but as someone who is a participant observer, so to speak. But getting back to who's Chaim Soloveitchik. So Chaim Soloveitchik, again, we know who his family, what family he came from, and his education, traditional education, Harvard graduate. His academics, the person who was his mentor was Jacob Katz, who I also have the privilege of writing my master's thesis under. Jacob Katz was maybe the preeminent Jewish historian of the second half of the 20th century. He was Hungarian-born. He was trained in Frankfurt, also a Talmid Chacham. And he introduced both the sociological models into the study of history in some of his very important works, most famous among them, Tradition and Crisis. And then towards the last decades of his life, he died in the early 1990s, he focused very much on orthodoxy, on history of halakha. His books, Halakha v'Kabbalah, Halakha v'Meitzar, his book on Hungarian Jewry and German Jewry, Keresh Aloni Tacha, all these books really...
The Shabbos Goy.
The Goy Shel Shabbat, the Shabbos Goy, about the history, development of Halakha from the Talmudic period till contemporary times, or till the late 19th century, early 20th century, of the approaches, economic and social and spiritual issues that contributed to the development of halakha. Katz was a unique figure who created fields. And he had a few major students who all have subsequently become leaders in medieval and modern and contemporary study of contemporary Jewry.
In the lengthy preface to the footnotes, which is almost an essay unto itself, Professor Soloveitchik calls out Katz for particular acknowledgement, essentially saying that without Jacob Katz's pioneering scholarship, a work like this could not have been written.
Well actually, just something that I've noticed is that Katz himself, early on in his career, sort of took a distance from what he was writing about and wrote in that way that 20th century people did, in that modernist way, as if, you know, this has nothing to do with me, I'm objective, just like one might think that biologists or chemists are objective, I have no stake in this. And towards the end of his life, he was more open about the fact that there were topics that he really cared about, and he even wrote an autobiography.
Yes.
With my own eyes, where he told his story, his personal development from Yeshiva Bachar, actually from a little, almost like a shtetl, or just actually a little town with only a few Jewish families, to his time learning under the Sofer dynasty in Pressburg, Bratislava, then moving to Frankfurt, being the tutor of the Breuer boys, and then moving to Israel, and eventually, after a big struggle, becoming professor in Hebrew University, and eventually winning the Israel Prize. So it actually is interesting that I don't think that Professor Soloveitchik was as... I'm sure he was as self-aware, but as open about the fact that this was a sort of... There's an autobiographical element to this whole article, but the fact that Katz's autobiography came out just a few years earlier, and Katz was focusing on Hungary, where he grew up, and focusing on issues that were viscerally important to him, and the fact that that Soloveitchik came to this, I don't think that they're completely unrelated. So but Soloveitchik made his reputation in the field of the history of the halakha of medieval times. I want it to be clear that beyond the thesis, beyond all sorts of mini sort of articles that appear in the footnotes and in different parts of this article, what you see is a person who is a brilliant mind, who is meticulous. Chaim Soloveitchik's language, command of languages, of geography, of economics, of social trends, of Christianity, of
Filterfish.
Well, you know, there it was a very famous
footnote early in the essay describes the history of Gefiltefish.
The history of Gefiltefish. So, but he came to the table being an extraordinarily meticulous person, and anyone who ever studied with him in any of his classes knew how demanding he is or was of his students, whether it be in the Talmud classes or in the history classes. And he didn't suffer fools. He doesn't suffer fools. He expects people to do scholarship on the same standard as his. But the things that interested him, I mean, many things, but the things that he took all that knowledge and he focused it in on, primarily on some of the key themes of Jewish life in Ashkenaz, in Franco-Germany, in the Middle Ages, in the High Middle Ages, fields. He's very interested in economic issues. And there's a two volumes have come out. There's a third volume that's going to come out from Littman Library, where you have the collection of many of his seminal articles. You also have a few books that he's written. So he wrote about money lending. He wrote about the wine trade and all sorts of conflicts and confluences between ritual law prohibitions of Yayin Nesach, of Stam Yenam, and the crucial role that wine trade and wine production played within the many of the areas in which very important Jewish communities lived, where Balei HaTosfot were operating, studying, where some of them actually were both teaching and writing their glosses on the Talmud, which became so critical to the way Talmud has been studied till now. At the same time, they were running vineyards, or they had family members who were very involved in the trade. So in that way he followed Katz. Very famous article, Mariv Bismano, Shalom Bismano, which analyzed the first Tosfot in Brachot, and how the conditions of daylight and darkness and danger and all sorts of things impacted the way...
And the social history of what nightlife meant in Europe at that time.
Absolutely, absolutely. So Chaim Soloveitchik really took some of those initial types of studies of Katz and to a whole new level. But he also dealt with issues which maybe some people who are less inclined to the economic, social aspect might look at as more spiritual and more existential, such as the issue of Kiddush Hashem, the issue of martyrdom, but also from the perspective of halakha and the degree to which the mimetic tradition in Ashkenaz, this idea of that when forced to choose between apostasy, conversion to Christianity, or death, the Ashkenazic, at least, tradition, one would say. I don't think they all did that, and one can always argue about to what degree it's a literary tradition, to what degree we have facts on the ground that this is the majority of position. But Chaim Soloveitchik,
that perception was analyzed
by Chaim Soloveitchik in a very important way through the lens of how halakha dealt with it, how halakha dealt with lo aleinu issues of allowing oneself to be killed, as opposed to committing suicide, as opposed to actually killing one's children rather than having them forcibly converted. A famous tshuva, for example, of Maharami Rotenberg, about a person who actually survived after he'd killed his family, and whether he had to do tshuva. All sorts of issues that Chaim Soloveitchik dealt with in the context of the development of halacha, and did so in a meticulous way, and wrote books actually methodologically trying to share that method and how it's done. And how
halachic sources can be a source of historical knowledge.
History, but following Katz, and maybe this is a little bit of getting picayune into the academia of things, but because I imagine some of the listeners here are people who are in the world of learning, neither Katz or Soloveitchik were the first people to realize that there's historical knowledge that you can pull out of studying a tshuva, studying a responsum, or studying other types of medieval, early modern, etc. One of the things that Katz did and Soloveitchik did extraordinarily well, or does extraordinarily well, is that they understood very clearly that a halachic source is not just about the question and the bottom line. It's not about often the shakla vitaria, often the interchange, often the minority opinions that are brought, often the local color which is indicated within some of those discussions actually tell us more about the society, about the theology, about the proclivities, about the social tensions, about the different approaches that exist within the text. And that one has to pay attention to that. Now, again, that takes a lot more learning. That takes a lot more knowledge. That takes a lot more understanding of this tension when a historian approaches a religious text. Because a religious text has a phenomenology to it. It has a life that is ahistorical, that is about the sugya that's developed, whether it be from the Midrash Halacha or certainly in the Mishnah Talmud, etc., and on through often Gaonim, Rishonim, etc. And a person who is immediately looking at that contextually, immediately trying to figure out what is like what we call historicizing the text and what are the outside factors, I think that Katz and Soloveitchik, and I take this to heart, and this is what I try to teach my students, I think that they're missing a big piece, regardless of one's emunot v'dayot. If you want to understand the breadth and the power and the historical importance of these sources, you have to first understand them inside and learn them as they were learned by people who weren't interested at all in their historical implications, who were interested in them as practical guides or as theological guides. And this is something I could say that for myself, I learned a lot of this initially actually in Bernard Revel studying with Schneer Lyman. I think that Katz and Soloveitchik in their writings really perfected that and turned it into something which is the model.
So to a certain degree, it's not surprising what he does in Rupture and Reconstruction, because he's taking those same kinds of methods, and the uniqueness here, the innovation, is to turn it not to a medieval halachic text, but to the text becomes the contemporary lived religious life of Orthodoxy in America in the 20th century.
Yeah, you could say it's not surprising. It's certainly not surprising the way he goes about it. I think that once he did it, I mean, and that's where those rich footnotes, and that's where the all sorts of little things where he, you know, his whole discussion of the development of the Mishnah Berurah, the Mishnah Berurah versus Aruch HaShulchan, Chazon Ish, the role of different Dat Torah, Das Torah, etc., where you see he's a person that anything that he thought was relevant, he had to go till the end. And that methodically is certainly the case. Nonetheless, there are a lot of surprising things about this text. It's surprising that a person who is so focused on how much you have to be a specialist in what you do and how much you have to know everything about your topic and how selective he was about how he writes. And by the way, another thing that makes this essay and all Soloveitchik's writings meaningful for people is that he's a wonderful writer.
He's a wonderful writer.
If you're not interested in medieval Jewry, if you just read three themes in Sefer Hasidim, again, a topic that had halacha, Kabbalah, mystical pietism. Trance, pietism, asceticism, etc. All those things together, you see a person who looks at scholarship as a literary act, and here we all need to learn from that, because so much of scholarship is brilliant, but it's inaccessible to people because of the sort of disconnect. So
let's get to the central thesis of and the fate of many scholarly articles. The fate of scholarship is sadly that it doesn't always have a resonance and impact on the street. Here's an example of a work, maybe for the reasons you described earlier, the author, the time, the venue, etc. This has a breakthrough to the popular imagination, a wide popular imagination within the modern Orthodox community he was attempting to speak to, and to adjacent communities in the Jewish world, and perhaps even further afield. But as is the fate of works that do have this kind of breakthrough impact, sometimes it's known more for its boiled down central thesis, the Reader's Digest version of Rupture and Reconstruction, than the article itself. There are certainly plenty of people within the larger modern Orthodox community in Israel and America and elsewhere who can tell you text versus mimesis without necessarily having read and studied and mastered the article, and can apply that kind of, pardon the expression, chakira to analyzing life, sometimes competently, sometimes indiscriminately. So let's get into, boil down for us, the central thesis of Rupture and Reconstruction, which, as I understand it, is at a certain point in American Jewish life, there was a transition from what he calls the mimetic culture, in which the rituals and daily structure of religious life are absorbed in the home and the community, to what he calls text culture. And that leads to a shift in the center of gravity and the source of authority from the home and the communal rabbi to the yeshiva and the Rashi yeshiva, and that this has a kind of, the term that was popular in the 1990s when the article came out 25 years ago, chumrizatzia, right? An increasing level of stringency of chumra in religious life. Is that a fair depiction of the central thesis, or flesh it out for us?
You know, we're not giving grades here, but I think that touches on the main themes. But I want to get to that first point. You know, why if this, assuming this is these are the key moments, why did that resonate to so many people in I guess you'd call it the broader modern Orthodox world? And I think that's because they felt under attack. They felt under attack from the Haredi world and the surging yeshivish and Hasidic world of late 20th century United States, and to some degree in Israel, although that was, I think, Israel's sort of a side point here and maybe one of the later criticisms, but just it's certainly not central. Although, just elaborate. Professor Menachem Friedman, very important sociologist, is also a student of Katz, wrote about issues relating to Chazon Ish prior to Soloveitchik, and Soloveitchik acknowledges them, but because it wasn't as accessible and because it was more limited in its microscope, so it didn't have the same resonance.
I think Chaim actually says that he wouldn't have dared to write the essay had he not known that Menachem Friedman had agreed with its central thesis.
Sure, because Menachem Friedman was a specialist in 20th century Jewry in pre-state and Israeli Haredi and Orthodox Jewry. But so they're under crisis there, but also under crisis from their children. And I think that this is something that we have to realize. My generation was the generation where going to Israel and studying in yeshiva for a year or two became accepted practice among a lot of the elite schools
almost
and families. And it's become more so. At that time, though, most of the kids were studying in yeshivas, where there was very strong Talmud halacha orientation. Today, there's a broader spectrum of yeshivot and midrashot for girls, for women, and all sorts of different possibilities, a little bit more tailor-made to students and to their backgrounds. There, in those days, most of the students who learned seriously, one of their responses was to get more serious about halacha. And to examine and sometimes be kind of critical about the communities they grew up in, about the tolerance the rabbi, the pulpit rabbis had for all sorts of things that went on there in the schools that they went to, the principals, etc. So there was a latent post-60s rebellion, so to speak, in that took place from the 80s. And Chaim Soloveitchik actually gives people sort of ammunition to say, hey, look what you're doing. Sam Heilman, in his book, Professor Samuel Heilman, on the Move to the Right, he has a whole chapter about the study in Israel and how it affected the whole trajectory of American Jewry. But I think in terms of the resonance of this article, the fact that if you even boil it down further than you did, Rabbi Sacks, and say, look, you come from a home. We're committed people. We're the people who, when everyone else was working on Shabbos, we created the Young Israels. We created Mizrahi here. We created the day school movement. We created Yeshiva University. We did all these things. We created Camp Morasha, Camp Moshavala. And now you're coming back from Israel and you're saying that what we're doing isn't serious, that we're not halachic enough, that we're not committed enough. And here comes along the heir to the person who is considered the most significant guiding light in the emergence of American modern Orthodoxy as an intellectually rigorous movement who was the person who ordained all these rabbis and his son, who's a great historian and therefore he has legitimacy that he's not just pontificating, rather he's a Talmud Chacham, he knows halacha, you can't deny it, and he comes and he says, what happened to my Maimonic tradition?
He brings he crafts a lovely anecdote in its footnote, it's endnote 18, and I'll just read it at length because it captures this, but it also is a wonderful example of the quality of the writing. It's just a pleasure to read. He says, the traditional kitchen provides the best example of the neutralizing effect of tradition, especially since the mimetic tradition continued there long after it was lost in most other areas of Torah life. Were the average balabosta, the average housewife, informed that her man, perhaps informed by her son who just came back from studying 2 years in Israel, but if the average housewife was informed that her manner of running the kitchen was contrary to the Shulchan Aruch, her reaction would have been a dismissive nonsense. She would have been confronted with the alternative, either that she, her mother and grandmother, had, for decades, been feeding their families non-kosher food, treifus, or that the code was wrong, or, put more delicately, someone's understanding of that text was wrong. As the former was inconceivable, that she and her mother and her grandmother had been feeding her family treifus, and the latter was clearly the case. This, of course, might pose problems for scholars. However, that was their problem, not hers. Neither could she be prevailed on to alter her ways, nor would an experienced rabbi even try. There is an old saying among scholars, a Yiddish balabosta takes instruction from her mother only.
This is just reminding me of when I came home from yeshiva and I wasn't sure if all the dishes had been tyfled. Yeah. And so I realized I wasn't going to get my parents to bring all their good china to the mikvah, even though, you know, there's a differing opinions about different types of china and et cetera, but I was a little bit of an Amma Aretz. So I waited for the first snowstorm because I knew that if you put you could tovel if it's a foot of snow. And of course, my father ended up having the flu and being sick in bed for a week because of my ignorance. But, you know, that's part of that That was my experience. But I just want to say about this is thesis. It's very important to realize that he didn't just pontificate. He's a historian, and he looked at the roots of this in Eastern Europe. And what causes this rupture? And that's crucial, because it's also where he brings to the table his knowledge of why the Rambam wrote the Mishneh Torah, and why Rav Yosef Karo wrote the Shulchan Aruch, and why other books are written out, and for that matter, maybe why the Mishnah came into being after the Korban. And the idea of how when there's a dissipation, or there's a dispersion, or there's a decline in something which was a constant, there's this need to preserve, to codify, to write it down.
I think on a number of occasions I heard him describe it as their periods of expansion and contraction.
Okay.
In the essay, he points to the rise of Art Scroll as the harbinger. Art Scroll and the early writings of Rabbi Shimon Eider of Lakewood, who prepared these types of halakhic handbooks.
And Yehuda
handbooks.
Greenwald as yeah, being so he, the pioneer.
So he points to
sure.
them as this kind of the harbingers of this new period of contraction of halakhic codes, which by definition, since you have to codify things and put it black and white, there's going to tend to erring on the side of safety, which leads to chumrah. In a rather felicitous example he gives is, how did you learn how to tie your shoes? Well, your mother sat with you on the floor, where you sat on her lap, and she showed you.
You didn't read the first siman in the Mishnah Berurah.
But right. Imagine trying to explain in writing, in a legal code, instructions for tying shoes.
Sure, sure. So it's really important to understand his essay in as he describes it, through the initial rupture of to a certain degree, secularization in Eastern Europe, but particularly World War I, destruction of communities, and of course, ultimately, the World War II and the Holocaust, and how you have organisms, living organisms, for years and years and years. You go to shul, this is the way you do it. You at home, you do it this way. The rav of the community is the Mara De'atra. Now, these all came at the same time of the rise of the modern yeshiva. The modern yeshiva doesn't mean the koed yeshiva. The modern yeshiva means velazhen, it means tells, it means mir, where you have what I am not the first to say it. I think Immanuel Eckes, even I think Rabbi Lamb, to a certain degree in his books, wrote that the Rosh Yeshiva being sort of a parallel to the Hasidic Rebbe, who you have this all-powerful person who is distributing monies, who is appointing people, who is considered this great scholar, like the great professors, etc.
And is in the ivory tower of the yeshiva.
Correct.
And not within the lived community of the woman who comes to you with her...
In most cases, you have cases where they were, but that is the stereotype, and that is certainly the model, and you have this elite group of students who are studying there, and this becomes the ideal, and therefore it usurps the role of home. And but as long as that's in a situation where there is continuity, there's a dialectic, or there's a tension. Once there's hagira, once there's immigration, once the old places don't exist and people don't get to new places, it sort of lets those forces of new authority, of what he calls textual authority, where the text becomes authoritative and the oral or personal or family tradition becomes, in most cases, and again, like Isaac Chevelle describes in his critique, there were certainly places where that wasn't the case, but the ambience that Chaim Soloveitchik tries to describe certainly it comes to fruition in the new worlds of America, Israel, etc. And here the irony, of course, is that together with his father being the paragon of modern Orthodoxy, he also celebrated texts. I mean, halachic man is a celebration of the meticulousness. It's many other things, but it's very critical of over theologizing a religious life. Maybe v'kashta misham less so, but there's certainly plenty in the focus on text, on the rav shir, on learning in a very very Lithuanian yeshiva way, that one could, if one wanted to argue it, say that those things contributed to the very thing that Chaim Soloveitchik is protesting. So it's an ironic, complicated situation.
I would say for halachic, this is in parentheses, but I would say for halachic man, the central idea is the importance of texts and halachic texts, principally the Talmud, as the definitive source of a worldview, the definitive source, the definitive lens through which to live and experience and understand the world.
Okay,
and it's also halachic meticulousness.
That could be translated into, well, if halacha is mimetic and it comes from the home, that's halachic man just as well. And I think that that's what Chaim Soloveitchik argues, and he even gives examples, and he's spoken about it in his mother's kitchen, etc. But nonetheless, I think that it's not difficult to see how once there is such a focus on law, meticulous of halacha, etc., that taken with the other factors, you know, it's a harbinger of the newer textual authority that takes
place. So is it the rupture, this transition from the mimetic home tradition to the text yeshiva tradition, is it that the mimetic runs out of steam at a certain point in America in the 20th century and then text comes to fill the vacuum? Or is it that text comes and launches an assault on the home tradition and vanquishes it? Or is it some kind of combination of the both?
I don't know the answer. What I can say is that I think something that doesn't get discussed in the article and I haven't seen really focused on is think about the ideals of immigrants or second-generation American Jewish families, modern Orthodox families, and their process of Americanization, and how much higher education becomes the ideal, becomes the vehicle, becomes the way that you become successful. So I think that one has to understand the role of the text in the rabbinic world in a broader perspective of higher education and how much veneration there was among our grandparents to those college degree, a graduate degree, a smicha, a person who controls
my son, the doctor.
Well, right, and once upon a time, even my son, the professor, or my son, the engineer or the scientist. Maybe less so now because of materialism or individualism, etc. Without being overly generalizing, but clearly. If my son comes back from yeshiva, or if I go to yeshiva and learning the sugya, and I now have those tools to dissect the text and to understand what those rabbis really were saying and what we're expected to, I think that that sort of authority of higher education of intellect is preeminent among sort of the aspiring middle class to upper middle class sectors of that really begin to populate modern Orthodox and sort of Lithuanian Jewry at that
now,
time.
Now, this concept, mimesis, or the mimetic tradition, which clearly enters the modern Orthodox lexicon in 1994 through this essay, this is a concept that has a long history going back to Plato and Aristotle, and then the long arc from the ancient Greeks until the early 20th century in the writings of the philosopher and literary critic Erich Orbach, who writes a book called Mimesis. That is talking about within a particularly literary criticism and other things, and here the concept is borrowed from those writings, which describe literature as a way of kind of reflecting the world. As mirroring the world. And that's the concept, you see how that's the commonality in the way that Soloveitchik is using it. The idea of mimetic from the same root as to mime or to mimic something, that you learn how to perform rituals by seeing how your parents did it. The famous example of the Chafetz Chaim's Kiddush cup. The Chazon Ish's Kiddush cup, right? In other words, you see how religion and ritual and halacha are lived within homes and communities, and that becomes the source of authority, like our Balabosta in her kitchen, from the footnote I read a moment ago.
Of course, the irony is that this dichotomy between mimetic and text is so complicated, because what starts as mimetic eventually is codified, etc. Whether in Minhag books or in the Ramah or wherever,
and then it circles back.
Exactly.
So obviously Chaim Soloveitchik understands this, and the kind of let's say simplification for the purpose of demonstrating that there are these two types of traditions that are on parallel, competing tracks. It was never all mimetic, and it was never, even today, it's never all been text. And as you said, it's a kind of Möbius strip that keeps feeding back into each other. But explain to us a little about the state of mimetic life, the state of mimetic culture within, you know, drawing on your day job as a working in the salt mines of social intellectual Jewish history. You know, what has been the place of this concept of mimetic, which was a concept we all understood until he put a name on it.
I don't want to disappoint you. I don't feel that I'm qualified to say something that's really categorical about that. I would say that I always looked at it. I never liked the term mimesis, mimesis in itself. I always looked at it as mimetic tradition. I always looked at it as, and I like the term that you used previously very much, live religion. And that's really what he's talking about. He's talking about the tension between codified or more generalized, lo plug religion, so to speak, and the actual how do people do this. And again, here I'm sort of going back to his own background. So much of his own writing about medieval Jewry was just about that. It's about that the about minhag and about the veneration that Ashkenazi Jews had for the ways of their parents. And here you see this in the text, but it's, you know, so in Shutim, for example, when Maram Padua, I believe, is asked about how could it be that Yeshiva Bachrim in Venice cross-dress, they wear women's clothes on Purim. Isn't there an Isser of Lotil Ilyobash Geva Beged Isha, etc.? And he says, well, yeah, it's complicated, but I remember when I was a yeshiva bacher in Germany, they did the same thing. But you have the same thing regarding Kiddush Hashem and martyrdom, where they say, yeah, it's very hard for us to find an asmachta in the Gemara. They search for the Tosfot looks for that story about the kids in the boat and jumping off, and afterwards Josephon and Masada and all this stuff. But basically, there's not a lot there that can support suicide and certainly killing one's children. And then some of them just say, look, we believe these people are Yirei Shamayim. We are absolutely convinced that they would only do that which they felt was permissible and desirable from God. And then we get to the point where the famous piyut of Ephraim of Bonn that Shalom Spiegel popularized, where he writes the story of Akedat Yitzchak, where Yitzchak is actually killed by Avraham, and then the dew comes down in his head and is brought back to life. So this veneration for the lived religion is something that I think Chaim Soloveitchik really focuses on in so much of his medieval writing, and I think that's part of what he brought to the table in his desire to focus in on what the core tension is among moderns.
We should start to wrap up our conversation, but I just want to ask you to briefly respond to a few more questions. Within the modern Orthodox community, the essay was latched onto because and I described this in my introduction to the symposium, my own encounter with it 25 years ago, because it became a lens through which we could suddenly look back on ourselves and understand ourselves and our community and our life in ways we hadn't understood. It was like lifting the veil from before our eyes, and we could see ourselves clearly. But in fact, the essay is as much about the Haredi ultra-Orthodox world as it is about the modern Orthodox world. So I'd like to ask you to say a word about how you think it reflects on trends within the ultra-Orthodox world, both then and today.
So I think, just again, I think it's because Chaim Soloveitchik gives a hechsher, so to speak, to a critique that a lot of people felt internally, but they couldn't articulate it. And he gives a historical hechsher and a name hechsher and et cetera. So I think that to me is something that we really have to focus on. In terms of the Haredi world, my conclusion is, it's not a conclusion, but one of the things that I've noted, and most of my work about the American Haredi world was clearly afterwards, is how much these dividing lines are fluid, and how much certainly segments of the modern Orthodox world and segments of certainly the Lithuanian Haredi world are less divided. So if you're talking about the things described in this essay, which I think that Chaim Soloveitchik would probably say are most reflected in the right-wing modern Orthodox, or we'll call it the centrist, or in the certain trends among leading Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva University, and maybe in institutions in Israel. Some would argue even our teacher, Rav Lichtenstein, who was very, very oriented towards a strict halachic position, also supported some of that, although he was a little bit broader in the scope of the way that, much broader in the scope of the way that he looked at these issues. So I think that in the Haredi world, there is certainly this veneration of text. But what's different about the Haredi world on this, and I don't think that this is really filtered into modern Orthodoxy, is the role of Gedolim. And I think that's something that, just like a lot of people think Hasidism is sweet and cute, but they don't understand that Hasidism is really about the Rebbe, and it's really about the Rebbe's role as the person who connects Shemayim Va'aretz, connects the people with the ethereal, with the divine, with the heavenly. I think that people are unaware of how much veneration of the Gedolim of the past, whether it be the Chazon Ish or the Chafetz Chaim or other figures, and of the present. And if you just go to a funeral, just see the way they're cited. I think that Chaim Soloveitchik does talk about this a little bit in the essay, and people don't pay enough attention to it.
Well, certainly in the sections that you
Das Torah, but not just there. It just the fact that it's not just that it is a text. It's who wrote the text. And this is often actually the criticism of academics or of liberal people who are smart and are able to read master text. You can master a text as much as you want, but if you're not venerated, I mean, in the Haredi world, it goes so far as basically you can't be a gadol before the age of 75, 80 years old. Right. There are people that say...
Fortunately, they all have long shelf life and live to be well past 100.
That's a big thing. I mean, like, you have someone like Rav Asher Weiss.
Survival of the fittest.
Who I don't know how old he is, but he's not considered a gadol yet. He's considered someone who is an Elui or has the potential to be. But there's a whole... I mean, think about Avani Yosef. I mean, it's in the Mizrahi world. It's a different world, but actually he only becomes a gadol after he leaves the chief rabbinate, and that's so I think that that's something. But having said that, I think the other thing about the Lithuanian Haredi world in American Israeli world is how much, other than sort of these ideological moments of venerating secular knowledge, of idealizing certain types of academics, of being open to certain types of popular culture, open to certain types of feminism, that the lifestyles are not that different from what you'd call the from modern Orthodox. And they all live in enclaves. They, it would be a very interesting analysis to take some of the so-called leading modern Orthodox communities and some of the leading Haredi communities in America, and from a sociological perspective, not from the specifics of what clothes they wear or what's institutionally attended, but from a sociological perspective, socioeconomic perspective, how different really are they? Not Lakewood, but maybe Passaic, or maybe some of the Long Island communities, or even parts of Flatbush, newer parts, etc. And I think it gets harder to parse those differences today.
I'll asterisk here without going into it for lack of time. You mentioned Rav Avadia Yosef. Of course, one of the potential critiques on Rupture and Reconstruction is its extreme Ashka normativity. The world of the Mizrahi communities, certainly here in Israel, but even in the United States, underwent much different sociological trends and changes, and we would have to have a different conversation about how this plays out, if at all, and in what ways within the Sephardi.
I'll say it even sharper. It's about white men. Okay? It
well, is. That brings me to the topic
exactly.
of your paper.
But I want to compliment you, and I think that it's a compliment really of Chaim Soloveitchik. A great essay is not one where everyone says yes.
Yes, certainly.
Okay, so. This essay is not Das Torah. What this essay is rich, and it is has a compelling, right. interesting perspective and thesis and knowledge, and it forces you to think. Right. I think that what is important about this edition of tradition that you put out and of the discussion that's taking place is that this essay is still valuable and useful to people as a foil, yeah. Not to take it as Torah Min HaShamayim, but as something that is useful for people to be self analytical and to think about what are the implications for this. And here, if I may, maybe you want to interject here. I don't want to, one of the things that I found ironic about the essay, and this is what I wrote about it in the tradition edition, is the fact that there's this celebration of the authority and power of text, and there's this actually reference to that a powerful moment where the Chafetz Chaim, Rav Yisrael Meir Kagan, the pious and great authority from Radin from Lithuania, who demonstrates his openness to some of the activities that Sarah Schneer and others were doing in the second and third decades, fourth decades of the 20th century to expose women and to open up the whole world of higher learning to women. Not Talmud at that time, but higher learning, and to have seminaries to teach women to be role models and to be intellectuals and to be the people who are inspiring other women to be focused on their religious and intellectual growth. And what Chaim Soloveitchik focuses on is the fact that what the Chafetz Chaim says is that we have to teach women Torah because they're not learning it in the home anymore. They're rejecting the home. They're going to advanced high schools. They're learning for the matriculation in the Polish system, and then they come home and they see that it's radud. It's simplistic compared to the sophistication of what they're learning in public school. And he says, well, in that case, you have to open up the text to them because you have to show them the beauty, the depths, etc. But what he doesn't talk about in this essay, I'm sure he's aware of it, but he doesn't talk about this, is that the irony that as soon as you open up the text, well, there's an agency to text that has nothing to do with this. You lose control because knowledge is power. And together with the sort of what's referred to as move to the right or Haredization or whatever you want to call it, the same exact change that the Chafetz Chaim becomes the symbol of is actually what opened the door for the beautiful world of women's Jewish learning that we have the privilege to live in today, and Migdal Oz and Lindenbaum and Matan, etc., and Nishmat and the Nishmat Hotline, and all these phenomena are also part of that power of text, which Chaim Soloveitchik focused on.
So I should just explain to the listener that this was the topic, or one of the topics, in your own contribution to the symposium, and actually quite a few of the 17 essays, each from a different angle, addresses this topic of what does it mean for women's religious life, for women's learning. The essay came out in 1994, well after the so-called revolution of women's learning had been underway. And he acknowledges in that preface that he's really not discussing that, although he said he hopes to write about it soon. And in the meantime, a quarter century later, we're still waiting for that. For that essay, but you address it and
others. Well, one anecdote is that it, not only that, but as Rabbi Saul Berman wrote recently in a reflective essay, Chaim Soloveitchik was a key figure in setting up that famous Talmud shiur that his father gave at Stern College, which opened up Stern College to Talmud learning. So it is, and that was before this essay came out. Yes. And it is kind of interesting that the actor and the scholar.
But there's no doubt that even though the movement to advance women's higher Torah learning was already underway, there's no doubt that in the past 25 years it's undergone tremendous changes in ways that may not have been imaginable in 1994. And certainly the central theses of the essay do deserve to be reexamined through everything we know that has happened in the last 25 years.
Absolutely. But I think
about this topic and about so many other topics.
Absolutely. But I think it's important to realize that if one wants to see text as deterministically leading towards chumrah, deterministically leading to a narrowing of the scope of religious possibilities, I think that whether one could have foreseen that already in 1994 or not, regardless, the fact is that the growth of women's learning and the growth of religious authority for women and of institutions, both in Israel and in the United States, some were more controversial than others, but the fact that even some which might have been controversial 30 years ago are now considered a mainstream, and they're the ones that are considered more avant-garde or radical wouldn't have even been part of the orbit then. I think that that demonstrates how one should be conscious that in certain ways, more than explaining the move to the right, what Chaim Soloveitchik did in his essay was to demonstrate how powerful and how authoritative a text can be when the people who are studying that are knowledgeable enough to be able to understand.
And it will lead in different directions.
Exactly.
Right? And that's the point.
Exactly.
That's why I wanted to have this conversation with you, Adam, because when you take such a, frankly, long and complex essay as Rupture and Reconstruction and boil it down to its al regel achat, its nutshell version, which sometimes is what is remembered out there in the world, there's an inevitable distortion. The idea, the oversimplification, that the mimetic was moderating and the text tradition leads to stringencies is not quite that simple. On the contrary, sometimes the move to the text undermined unnecessary stringency.
And that's why in the Haredi world, what I said about Gedolim is so crucial, because what the Haredi world really does is that they say that there are only certain people who have the right to analyze the text, to draw conclusions from the text. But because, and this may be the crucial distinction at this point, because the modern Orthodox world is a more intellectually broad world, because exposure to academics, because of all sorts of reasons that we can't go into here, I think that there's more openness to the fact that a person who demonstrates basic commitment to religious life, etc., but has acquired this tools, knowledge, etc., they have the right to offer their interpretation. And if that interpretation is accepted by a committed community, that interpretation becomes valid. And I think that's something that in the Haredi world is not accepted. Right.
So that's, again, one of the ironies of the piece is that, well, it was latched onto by a modern Orthodox community that at the time felt itself a bit under assault, that the kind of moderate centrist attitude was being undermined by stringencies, the old jokes about the chumrah of the weak club and things like that. And here along, as you said, along comes Chaim Soloveitchik and explains to us that there's something inauthentic in that movement. But that overlooks the fact that that's not actually what he's saying at all. He's saying that these transitions come with a lot of complexity. And sometimes it's going to produce a result to the right, sometimes it's going to produce
and
a result
the way,
to the left.
And by the way, one of the interesting
things... I know, and there's an irony. The afterlife of the essay, the way that these central theses of the essay have been used as proof texts to both by the right and the left to underscore, to bring heft to their arguments in some very surprising ways.
So I mean,
I should just say this is another topic that's addressed in your essay. And we'll leave it to the reader to go and discover in what way you make this point.
With pleasure. I just say that one of the things that's interesting is that today there's a blurring between halachic and other types of texts. I mean, there was always that. I mean, the Talmud is what's so beautiful about Talmud is that it is that blur. But nonetheless, think about the rise of Neo-Hasidism, which is written about a little bit in this edition, and how people are going back to texts of the Ishbitzer, and going back to the Kutzker, and going back to all these people who have sort of a semi-antinomian sort of trope in their writings, and because it's written down by somebody who's considered a great Hasidic Rebbe, and not just by Shlomo Kalibach, or by someone who is, from the Kabbalah Center, sometimes that gives it an authority which is beyond. And here, I think you have the extreme case of when a text is considered canonic, and I think it's that canonization of the text which gives it agency, which can sometimes fuel. Rabbi Sacks said, not only a move necessarily towards more stringency or more conservatism, but actually towards radicalization and towards sort of an archaeology of old positions and application to new situations.
This has been a long conversation, but it's a long essay, so we need time to get through it. And of course, there'd be nothing better for the listener than to go and find the essay. It can be accessed on the website of traditiononline.org for free and to read it. And while you're there at our website, traditiononline.org, maybe it's time to subscribe or resubscribe, or certainly just to enjoy our free access archives and to read a few of the essays in the current issue that contains 17 contributions to a symposium on Chaim Soloveitchik's Rupture and Reconstruction. Professor Adam Furziger of Bar-Ilan University, thank you for helping us understand why this essay has had the impact in our community over these many years.
And thank you very much for the privilege of talking with you about it and for learning from you as well. Thank you.